I can't start doing the story without an introduction here. So there's several things that need to be said. One is, in speaking of living your past, as I was doing in the last 2 weeks, I wasn't giving you details without an overall picture or an image to relate to. And in advising you to make one choice and declare your eternal past and be that and live it in any form and expression you desire, I wasn't speaking of suscitation. In other words, everybody seemed to think that I was talking in the last couple of weeks about suscitation. I wasn't. I was talking about other things to create a background for getting into and understanding suscitation. In fact, I wasn't even speaking about suscitation at all. There seemed to be something going on that I was talking about suscitation, but I wasn't telling you what I was talking about. Well, that was because I wasn't speaking of suscitation. I was giving you things to consider, issues to consider, things I wanted you to consider before we got into talking about suscitation. So, when you said, well, I don't know, understand what you're talking about, I don't understand suscitation. Well, that's right, because I hadn't talked about that. So I wanted to give you things to consider or to wonder about. Now, when I say wonder about, that does not mean to question or ponder or puzzle over or even to doubt. To wonder about is to expand and make wondrous or extraordinary. For that alone will expand and extend yourself in life. See, you've always taken probably, if I had asked ahead of time, the definition of wonder and wonder about, you've always taken the negative pathway. Putting matters into a fixed context narrows and limits what I'm saying. Do you understand that? And it restricts your wondering. And it restricts yourself in life. Having a context or a complete picture or image of what I'm saying or what you're doing or what you're living restricts your wondrous life. Got that? And if we talk about, as we talk about these things, every time we talk about them, you all somehow want an overall picture of yourself in life. And when you do that, when you seek an overall picture of yourself and life, you shrink everything, yourself and life, and everything away from wonder. Okay? I just thought I'd say that again. By the way, does anybody there, can you conceive of going beyond complete? Anybody want to tackle that? Because if I give you a picture, an overall picture of what I'm saying, that kind of creates a completion, doesn't it? And that completion then restricts what I'm saying, and it restricts your understanding of what I'm saying. Is it possible for you to create your own completion, if there is a completion, or go if I give you a picture of what I'm talking about, how will you be willing to go far beyond whatever I'm saying? Well, no comments. We'll move right along. So we're going to talk about the story, my story of a period of suscitation that occurred to me 40 years ago, plus or minus a little bit here. It's actually a little over 40 years ago. And this was written about over 25 years ago, after all this occurred, and I thought I would keep a record of all of this going on. So it was written 25 years ago, 1986, that's 25 years ago, yeah, okay. Now, what it is sort of a docudrama. It's a documentary, and yet it's a drama. And what I mean by that is the fact that the names, the faces, the places, and descriptions of the people involved in the story hopefully are not recognizable, although a bunch of those people are not even alive today. The guys are not, but their wives are all still alive. And so I had to scramble it up quite a bit, because in Fairbanks I didn't want everybody to know who everybody was and in the story. So that part of the story of my life is slightly askew, and that's just to protect the innocent and the guilty. Two things occur. One is that at this time, my wife was locked up in a mental hospital. So in the story, I had to kill her off. It was just easier to kill her off than to deal with all the problems of the mental hospital situation. And secondly, well, there are other things going on. So we won't go into the second thing. So, anybody want to ask or say anything? And in this story, I am the Jason Roberts that this talks about, the person Jason Roberts. It's called The 7 Days of Creation. And maybe that the 7 days will, why the title will come out. Probably I won't read enough of this story. Oh, I know, that was the other thing. Now I'm starting this, and I'm going to read it as it is, rather than just go to the part where the suscitation started and what part of that was all alike. I'm going to start as the book started, telling you about my life at that time. And the reason for that is this. You'll find out later on that all of the events in the suscitation then sort of took on a life of their own in my everyday life. It's like as if, as I've tried to explain before, you're living a physical life and a parallel eternal life, and that they're exchanging parts and pieces such that in suscitation or in contact with your eternal self, you're very likely to find out that a lot of the things that occur in that period or time then following occur in your life. Or, like as in dreams, dreams often are either precognitive and occur in your about your life before it occurs, or it occurs in your life afterwards. So, in order for that to show you how that occurred, I'm going to just read this story as it is, and So you'll be able to see how it is a full sort of double life. Let's see, anything else? Oh, the part I didn't change is the part in various excursions into suscitation, or my eternal self, and into the events of suscitation. That didn't make any difference because there's nobody in that aspect of myself in life that anybody could identify in Fairbanks. So recognize that this occurred back in the late 60s, early 70s, and was written in 86. So, if there is nothing anyone wants to say, I guess we'll start reading. And in the long run, I'm only going to read you about three. Oh, by the way, this first part, like I said last week, is book 4C. And that is and has been up on the website so that you're welcome to read that if you want to. Anybody? Did anybody, after we said that it was up there, anybody, by the way, read ahead?
No, where is it again?
4C.
4C. No, I hadn't read it. I didn't know that's what it was.
4 Charlie.
And just one question. You changed your name in this because you didn't want people identified, or you didn't want to be identified either, or...
Yeah, so that all that kind of identification, the contractors, the designers, the builders, would not necessarily be identified.
Okay.
Okay. Are we ready to go? If we are, we'll go. The phone suddenly rings, irritating the room. Then, insistently, it rings again. Damn, Jason throws his pencil down, mumbling. I'll never get this done. Well, Jason is a well-respected architect, sort of a loner, and as usual, he's tired and frustrated. Jason Roberts, he declares to the telephone, exasperated, while hunching up his shoulder to hold the receiver, so he can talk on the phone and continue drawing with both hands. Mr. Roberts, the phone asks sweetly. My name is Freeston. Jason's exasperated attitude makes him this simple announcement, well, sound like a warning, which makes him stop and sort of light a cigarette. My husband and I would like to talk to you about designing a house for us. Well, I'd be glad to talk with you. Actually, he likes the voice and can't wait to meet it. But I'm awfully busy right now, he hears himself say. Then he shrugs and almost drops the phone. When do you want to get together? Don't sound too eager, Jason cautions himself quietly, then informs the phone. This afternoon I have a terrible rush finishing some drawings. But hears himself ask hopefully, how about tomorrow or sometime after 9 o'clock? Oh, my husband won't be able to get free tomorrow. He's an attorney and he'll be in court all day. And I have my hair done in the morning. Jason winces at the announcement because as busy as he is, he wants to meet the voice on the phone, which asks, could we get together at, say, 2 in the afternoon? Now, that's a question he's delighted to answer. For Jason has always believed that somehow his destiny in life would arrive by telephone or with a knock at the door. Maybe this is his destiny calling. Sure, my office, about 2:30, Jason mumbles, not really listening to what he's saying, because he's just misspelled a word on his drawing. He decides to quit working and pay closer attention to the telephone. But it's too late. Thanks, I'll see you at your office, 2:30 tomorrow. The phone goes dead. And Jason knows he's made another big mistake in not listening carefully. The phone usually rings when he's busy, and he always irritates people by the way he speaks on the phone. They think he's angry. He isn't angry. Maybe he's concerned that each call will take him away from his beloved architecture. Or maybe each call or a call will summon him to some other purpose in life. For Jason always knew he was destined for, well, he could never quite finish that thought. And for some strange reason, the voice sounds like a summons. Have I just made an appointment with my fate or my doom, he wonders. Jason isn't sure, but he likes the voice, soft and quiet, eager, and quite sexy. Well, whatever, back to work. They're always eager to start designing, and they'll probably want it yesterday. Jason mashes out his cigarette, promises to stop smoking, stands up, and searches for his crumpled pack of cigarettes and matches. What the hell did I do with those damn matches? Jason pokes around under papers and books scattered all over the layout table beside him and on his drafting board, and even looks under everything piled on the desk behind him, all the time mumbling, I gotta quit these damn things. He goes through his shirt pocket, checkbook, 3 pencils, comb, 2 pens, shopping list, and a mint. But no matches. He stuffs the mint in his mouth and pats his side pockets. They gotta be here somewhere. He lifts more papers, finds the matches, and lights the cigarette. Then drops into his chair, leans back, and crosses his feet on the edge of the drafting table, all in one motion. This is Jason Roberts, architect, 38, at the top of his career, nervous, tense, never really relaxed, but passionate about everything he does. Yet nothing he does quite satisfy him. And nothing he does quiets the voice within him to fulfill his purpose and his fate. Jason feels he's being guided or groomed or called in life. Yeah, sure, but called to what? To those who don't really know him, Jason seems, well, a bit angry and arrogant and almost out of control. Yet to those who do know him, he's confident and passionate, and always in control of himself and his life. He had smoked in school, but one day decided to quit, and hadn't smoked for 12 years. But here he is, after 6 months, smoking like he's never stopped, and never would stop. His office is a mess. Every desk is covered with drawings and specifications and letters and coffee cups, several of which have green mold floating on last week's coffee. Or is that last month's coffee? Jason likes his coffee with lots of cream and sugar, lots of it, because he seldom eats regular meals, but old coffee with cream and sugar quickly turns moldy with neglect. Empty beer bottles are scattered around on the edges of several tables. Jason gets up to throw the bottles in the cardboard box he uses as a trash container. Mumbling, clients don't mind a little mess because, well, that's expected of a busy architect. And it's accepted. You know, but beer bottles and moldy coffee cups are just a little too much. Jason had worked all night on his latest design and had been drinking beer or coffee with every pencil line. It's the same routine with Jason. Work too much, fidget too much, then smoke too much. And after a few hours of smoking, Jason wants a beer or sweet coffee to soothe his irritated throat. And that's the way he works all night, with old-time radio tapes filling the room with The Shadow Knows, or Fibber McGee and Molly, and I Love a Mystery. And Jason returns to himself, takes a sip of warm beer, lights another cigarette, and hunches over his drafting board to finish the renderings of his new design. He looks admiringly at his latest work and smiles with a bit of satisfaction. Several times in the past, Jason was so pleased with the designs that flowed effortlessly from his fingers that he felt he should end his career and do something else, simply because he felt, well, he'd never be able to design a finer building than that. And this is another one of those moments. Only this time, the flat, stale beer intrudes on his lively feelings. People frequently declare, love it or hate it, you can always tell a Roberts building. Jason wants people to be passionate about his work, for he deeply loves being an architect, and it shows in every building, and he hopes all people passionately love their life and the work, and that work as thoroughly as he does. But he knows, you know, that's really not so. Jason accepts each project and the next because he feels that, well, in some unusual way, he's being tested and guided and prepared, but he doesn't know why. He's felt this way for a long, long time. But why are these thoughts playing with him now? Before the telephone interrupted, Jason had letter titles on his drawing. Valley View Condominiums, Jack Benson, Inc. Jason hates the name Valley View. Jack's the owner. Northwest Mutual Savings Bank is providing the financing. Oh, and the project will be built by a local contractor. Jason hopes that Barry Construction will be the successful bidder because they're reliable and they're easy to work with. Then, of course, there will be subcontractors, carpenters, and suppliers, and the people who will live in the condos. All of these people must be proud of their involvement and really feel that without them, the project just wouldn't be complete or wouldn't be as grand. Thus it is with the architect. Everything he creates must be given away to everyone involved. Oh, how many times Jason's heard clients say, Jason, you may have designed this building, but it's ours. And though at first Jason resented hearing those words, he soon learned that everyone involved had to reject him as the designer in order to make it theirs. And he frequently wonder if God feels the same way, in that he created the universe and the life within it, and then has to give it all his work away to each person so that each person can take pride in his own life. Do you suppose God feels rejected? Jason wonders. Or is this God's offering to us so we can, well, sort of make it ours? Most of Jason's clients are much alike. They want all the credit, and Jack's no exception. Though Jason had hoped that this time things would be different. For when Jack first came to Jason, he said, I want you to design the finest condominium units possible on my Valley View property. I'll set the budget, and that'll be no problem. And I'll leave the entire design in your hands. That'll be your building. I'm tired of the crap in Fairbanks. I want a real prestige project in the hills for the new oil executives. What more could Jason ask for? And as the design progressed, Jack kept his word and gave Jason a free hand, well, and all the credit. But after the preliminary designs were complete and printed in the newspaper, and the original brochures were sent out, Jack began referring to the plans as, well, our design. Of course, this change usually occurs in clients as the drawings are displayed and admired. Then they begin taking credit for Jason's design. And of course, whenever Jack, like all the others, received unfavorable comments, he would say, well, I told Roberts not to do that, but he insisted. I guess he'll have to change a few things. Jason wonders if God feels the same way when people declare they create their own universe or reality. Then they complain when things go wrong. Does God say, well, I told them not to eat the fruits from the tree of knowledge of good and evil in the garden, but they wouldn't listen. Do you suppose God blames us? And now, as the final drawings are being completed, Jack has been referring to, well, my design. Well, Jason should have known better. All climates are. Well, sort of. The telephone rings again. Jason Roberts. Hi, Jason. How are my designs coming? Are you going to be finished in time for the 3 o'clock board meeting? This is a special meeting, you know. We're going to give final approval to my designs. And I don't want anything going wrong. Are the drawings ready? Jack has a habit of talking on the phone without ever announcing himself, as if everyone is supposed to always know who's calling. Never mind any announcement. This is God calling. And then he launches into several questions at once, without ever waiting for replies. No sweat, Jack. I have a few finishing touches to make, but I'll bring 3 sets of prints and by your office by 2 o'clock, with the colored renderings. Do you want me at the meeting to answer questions? Nah, I can handle that. No sense in getting too many people involved. I know these guys, and I can talk them into anything. You just get the drawings here no later than 2:30. See you, kid. And Jack hangs up without waiting for a reply. Jason slams the receiver down. Damn him! Jason doesn't really mean that. In fact, he actually likes Jack. But he knows that Jack's real reason for not wanting him at the meeting is so he can take all the credit for his drawings. Jason can hear Jack's opening statement now. Gentlemen, I've called this meeting for approval of my design for our condos on the Valley View property. The architect has finally completed these drawings, and I want to get them working on construction documents as soon as possible. Well, Jack can fool the board, but the design is Jason's, and he's not going to give it away to anyone. After all, he's been creating his design for 7 weeks of long hours and intense work. And that kid stuff. Jack's only 4 years older than Jason, yet he always calls him kid. And it irritates Jason. It's his way of controlling people, he mumbles. Oh, well, another smoke, then back to work. At 2:45, Jason walks into Jack's office and speaks to Joanne. That's Jack's secretary. Hi, love. Is Jack in? Joanne looks relieved and sighs. In? He's had me call your office every 5 minutes since 2:15. The door to Jack's private office is open, so Joanne doesn't even bother using the intercom. She slides out of her desk chair, accompanied by the rustling sound of nylon stocking and a silk dress. Real silk. Jason watches her legs walk across the room to Jack's office and disappear. Send him in, Jack's voice declares, loud enough to be heard in the waiting room. Jason walks to Jack's door just as Joanne turns around. Yeah, good planning, he mutters to himself. He likes Joanne, but she's resistant and won't go out with him. He enjoys being close to her, An acorn stands in her way until Jack's impatient look interrupts his little game. Jason lets her squeeze by, just barely squeeze by. And then he turns his attention to Jack. Here are the drawings, Jason announces as he opens his portfolio. As soon as the board approves, we can start construction drawings. Want to see them? Great, Jay. Haven't time to look now. I'll call you after the meeting. We're ready to start in 10 minutes. See you later, kid. Jack takes the drawings from Jason and hurries out to Joanne's desk. Grab a pencil, Joe. The meeting's about to start. Then he hurries down the hall to the conference room with Joanne hurrying to catch up, rustling seductively down the hall. Jason's left alone. While weeks of his work is carried off, he sighs. Jason hates the letdown that always occurs after giving a client the drawings. He's all keyed up, and at the same time, he's completely exhausted. Exhausted from working days and nights. So he kind of leans against the door jamb, lights another cigarette, and stares blankly, deep in thought. What a stupid way to hang doors. Maybe someday, oh damn, there I am with my largest and best project being judged, and I'm thinking about hinges and hanging doors. Well, I asked for it. What's the use? Why should I work to death designing? What's the purpose of that? And who actually gives a damn anywhere? This is Jason's usual letdown. The only one he permits himself. But he never lets it discourage him. Jason allows himself to feel sad and is, sometimes disappointed. But he's never discouraged and never depressed. Actually, right now he's kind of excited. And at the same time, he's content. But he knows he's done his very best, and that's what's important. Actually, nothing Jason does is really so important, but it kind of seems important that Jason does it. A hot cigarette ash falls past his hand and lands on the floor, and Jason unthinkingly rubs it into the carpet with the toe of his sandal. Jason's been wearing sandals in Alaska for years, even in winter. The slight movement brings him out of his thoughts, and he scuffs across the waiting room like a sort of a naughty boy to the entry. Driving back to his office, Jason still can't shake his mixed feeling. Why can't I just offer my buildings to the world and walk away? After all, I gained everything in having the privilege of creating the designs and drawing them. I don't really need any more than that. But Jason, still immersed in his mixed feelings, is driving too fast, deep in thought, and almost runs a red light. He's been working toward this day since the fifth grade. Thinking back, he remembers that afternoon with a slight smile. The teacher was explaining an arithmetic problem to the class. But he wasn't listening, not even paying any attention. He'd finished this problem and the ones on the next page the night before. The teacher droned on and on. But Jason had learned long ago with his mother to turn her off and to turn the world off while he privately followed his own dream. Today he doodled in the arithmetic paper. Benjamin Jason Roberts. Benjamin J. Roberts. Jason liked his name, yet at the same time he didn't. Something just wasn't quite right. How about B.J.R.? He wrote each name and initial in seven different styles, sort of with a flair, trying to develop a name and a signature with character. Sort of a signature which showed individuality and the importance he felt he was due and is destined for. B.J. Roberts. B. Jason Roberts. B. Jason. And then he wrote B as in B.E. B. Jason Roberts. Interesting. Jason likes the name Benjamin, but he truly likes, well, no more than likes, he truly loves being Jason. And from that day on, as a little boy, he insisted that everyone call him Jason so he could really sort of be Jason Roberts. Jason smiles again as he remembers that day and waits for the light to turn green. B. Jason Roberts always makes him smile unconsciously. He had driven 6 blocks through heavy traffic, sort of automatically, while daydreaming. Actually, he frequently drives cross town deep in thought, dreaming and designing. But you got to ask yourself, who's guiding and directing him? Actually, who's driving? For Jason's been far away in thought, too far away in thought to drive. So who is driving? Well, today the traffic lights are against him, irritating his mood. Jason hates traffic lights, stop signs, standing in lines and waiting. Oh, especially waiting. Like sheep, always waiting. Jason has too much to do with his life and too much to offer to the world. But is this real? Or is he, well, sort of fooling himself? Or is he just being tested and taught a lesson about patience? The light changes to green, but a car ahead signals a left turn, blocks both lanes of traffic, and stops in the middle of the intersection. Damn! Waiting for the entire lane of oncoming traffic to pass before ever even attempting a left turn to get out of the way, get out of the intersection. And the car ahead of Jason won't even move around the left turner. So Jason has to wait, sit and wait. And then the light turns red again. Frustrated, Jason grabs another cigarette, throws the pack on the dashboard and jabs at the lighter. His habitual routine when frustrated. Though his instinct is to just drive through the damn light. Let the rest of the world sit and wait. I have things to do. Of course, he has nothing really important to do right now. But any action is better than just waiting. Jason constantly watches for a yellow light in the cross lane of traffic, so he'd be ready to move ahead. Green light! Jason immediately shoves his shift into drive and shoots through the intersection and returns to his thoughts. Be Jason Roberts, he says to himself softly. Oh, he likes the sound of it. His name is his, well, it's his symbol and his philosophy. Feeling the importance of his name in high school, Jason looked up the meaning of Benjamin in the library and discovered that Benjamins are optimistic and have many abilities. Oh, they're destined and purposeful and will make their mark in the world. And they love their family. Yet they're independent and love that independence with sort of a passion and a flair. Jason's high school insisted he register as Benjamin, which was okay, but he never told them that he was living a secret life being Jason. Who knows? Who knows himself and his and is infinitely and insightfully aware of others. And because of his research into the meaning of names, Jason knew long ago that he, well, as a Jason, would develop new insights about life and bring them to the world. Jason once thanked his mother for his name. She just thought he was being a little peculiar. Yeah, but she was used to that. From those days on, so many years ago, Jason has lived and succeeded confidently, well, almost arrogantly. And he's been honest with his opinions and is with his words with others, which some people consider to be sort of brutally honest. Jason's response is to remind them of Harry Truman, who once said, "I don't give them hell. I just tell them the truth and they think it's hell." Jason hadn't planned to be an architect, no. Although he had written a report on architecture in high school, he wanted to study advertising. But schools were crowded after World War II, and college degrees in advertising weren't being offered. So he registered to study architecture, intending later to take special courses in advertising at a city college. But after less than a year of designing, Jason knew he was an architect. For here was all the honesty, truth, purpose, and self-satisfaction he'd ever hoped for. As an architect, well, he could honestly be Jason Roberts and bring fresh imaginative insights, well, to life, about life. Well, little did he know. Jason felt unloved as a boy. Well, no, he felt falsely loved. Now his love of architecture and his work honestly fill his love. But it naggingly still leaves a void that Jason can never quite fathom. And he can never quite fill. Something even sort of greater than his love of architecture is to come to him. But what is it? What is to come to Jason? Well, Jason's shyness and blunt honesty hindered good communication with many people. But this gave him a reason to develop a new language of his designs and his construction and completed buildings. And he let them speak for him. Where words failed or where words were faulty, his architecture expressed his true feelings. But this new language and way of communicating through images, descriptions, and forms, well, it had to be learned. So Jason studied hard, learning the language of his craft. Until now, his designs are, well, they're a fine way of communicating. And they are his finest expressions of life. But he's beginning to feel that even his architecture is too limited, because it doesn't really convey all that Jason wants to show the world. Music, art, poetry, religion, philosophy, all fail. I lost my place. Sorry about that. What happened? Is that what that was? Oh. We had a little earthquake, and I thought somebody had bumped the table and a lot of things like that, but we really just had an earthquake. That's what went wrong. No big deal. So, back to where we were. Music, art, poetry, religion, philosophy, they all fail to truly communicate clearly. Life has more to convey than all of man's ways and language. What's your language of life, he frequently asks people. Is he searching for a new language of life? Yeah, maybe. With success came the seeds of doubt and loss of confidence. But Jason never lets any doubts or concerns grow or become issues, because he has always followed his name, his identity, to be Jason Roberts. Jason is a self-declared and fully supported by his personal declaration of life. Yeah, but now, for some odd reason, his concerns are beginning again. And if they take root, the fruits might be doubt and loss of all he truly desires. But living those concerns forces Jason to ask, well, why? About himself, his profession, his family and friends, and his clients, and about religion, his existence in the world, and especially about his purpose in the world. What is life all about? And what will his life be this time? Jason has a long-standing tendency to, well, sort of think in questions, and then answer himself with even more questions. This habit helps him be a fine architect, for he constantly looks for and finds better ways of solving his clients' intimate problems. But questions answered by questions frequently leads to doubts. And these doubts rise in an endless sequence of questions and more doubts. Stop looking, accept what is, was everyone's advice to Jason. Jason couldn't even accept this advice. His impatience and frustration drove him until, well, now, though he's succeeding in his profession, he's more concerned than ever about the real meaning and purpose of his life. Jason turns into the driveway of his office on 8th Avenue, which is also his house, built around, well, 1912. The house is pretending to be a classic colonial revival style house, with white clapboard siding and a steeply pitched roof of green shingles, and a small dormer at the attic. Jason's not happy with the green shutters. The color's all wrong. Actually, everything seems so wrong. And yet, everything is just right. Funny how that happens, Jason ponders. And then quickly remembers the day he and Vicky purchased their all-wrong, just-right house with a stately row of Doric columns across the front porch, supporting a simple pediment centered on the roof to, well, sort of accent the entry. Just right. He and Vicky dated in high school and had been married soon after his graduation from college. And that left Jason free to pursue his architecture, while his personal life sort of took care of itself. For of course, Jason considered architecture to be his most intimate personal life. They had three sons, Earl, John, and Alan. They moved to Fairbanks, Alaska in 1959 to homestead. And then Vicky became ill and later died in an automobile accident 2 years ago. It was a long story that Jason frequently thought about, and in the thinking about it, that period of his life slowly faded away as though he is preparing for, well, something entirely new. But what? Turning into his driveway, it makes Jason more aware of his driving. He sighed. It kind of sort of relaxes him. Then sitting up straight and alert and gripping the steering wheel harder, he's able to concentrate more intently. While thoughts and images of Vicky continue flashing through his mind, Jason learned years ago that for him, concentration is not a narrowing of focus and awareness, but is an opening and a broadening of awareness. And the more intently he concentrates, the greater and broader his vision. It's as though he turns himself over to sort of someone else to carry on while he concentrates. Two distinct people seem to be alive in Jason. Maybe the other person is Benjamin. This isn't a spiritual aspect of Jason or a higher self. This is a distinct person, an intimate partner. Jason and his other person live as, well, intimate partners, just as he and Vicky were intimate partners. When they decided to sell their homestead and move into town and move his office from an old warehouse in the railroad yard, Vicky wanted to buy a Craftsman bungalow on 4th Avenue. But Jason preferred this house because it's similar to a Virginia farmhouse he lived in during high school. well, in the 1940s. Besides, the bungalow was just too small for a family of five and an architectural office as well. Historical records show that Jason's house had originally been built by Eve Adams, sort of a professional woman in town who serviced gold miners. Business was brisk in those days when millions in gold was being mined in the hills around Fairbanks. Her action was downtown on 3rd Avenue, an area known as the Line. But Eve Adams, well, that was probably her professional name, had many girls working for her, so, well, she could just live pleasantly and quietly 7 blocks away. Now Jason lives and works in her house, though his profession is, well, a little different. And he likes to joke that the world's first and second professions are still living and working together. Jason and Vicky both love the idea of redoing Eve's elegant house. In fact, Vicky always said that they were sort of reclaiming the past so it becomes a working part of the present and off into the future. And the remodeling had caused many problems between them, but, well, Jason doesn't like to think of those things. He's having enough difficulty just driving to the garage. Between the snow shoveled to each side of the narrow drive. Did I tell you it's January in Fairbanks after a record snowfall? Which means that because of snow piling up where it has been shoveled, Jason's driveway is sort of getting narrower and narrower. Such that now, after a near record snowfall, he can barely drive to the garage, which was, by the way, originally built as a woodshed during a time when, well, a winter supply of firewood had to be stored. The shed was designed for access by horse-drawn wagons and freighting sleds, not for automobiles. Many of Jason's clients think it's ridiculous for a successful architect to be living and working in an old remodeled house instead of designing his own place. But, well, he isn't concerned with such appearances, and certainly not by these opinions. Besides, he loves his old house, and so do the boys. And he likes the image and statement it makes about him. Jason's, he's a bit old-fashioned. Such that his buildings are simple and uncommon on the outside, you know, but they're sort of elegant on the inside. None of the current stale modernism for him or for his client. Of course, Jason's elegance is a bit tarnished today in his messy office. Jason's Mustang is stuck in the driveway, and after several unsuccessful tries to free it. Well, since the town is in a natural January warm spell, he decides to dig it out in the morning. Ah, the hell with it. Jason gathers up his day's mail and several sets of plans and specifications and the groceries from the back seat, and he struggles to the side door, which he unlatches and kicks open. That's his usual way of entering the house when his hands are full. Damn, I should get someone to come in here once a week and clean up this place. The house is a mess. This isn't good for the kids, he grumbles, to no one in particular, as he puts away the groceries and makes a peanut butter sandwich. The boys are going to a party at Billy's house after school and won't be home until 6. Well, you know, Jason loves his sons, but, well, it's a problem raising 3 young boys by himself, but he's learning. And he eats better when in cooking for the kids. But tonight it's peanut butter. Jason takes his sandwich to the dining room and lies down on the couch to think about his day and follow his mind images as they race around in his head. The front door of Jason's house enters directly into a center hallway with an ornate, stairway rising to the bedrooms above. Oh, he likes to visualize Eve slowly and elegantly descending the stairs to greet visitors. The image always brings a smile to his face and to his mind, even on difficult days. Eve must have had many fine dinner parties because her kitchen across the back of the house and along the side is quite large, even by today's standards. And it has a cast iron wood stove used mostly for heating and a fancy gas range with oven for cooking. The kitchen even has a summer room for sort of informal eating and activities, which truly pleases Jason because he loves summer and only tolerates winter. Though he loves that wood stove, it keeps the summer room toasty warm even at 30 below. Outside. So in winter, he and the kids do most of their cooking and baking on the wood stove and eat in the summer room, which creates summer in the kitchen and in their lives all year long. As large as Eve's dining room was for her grand parties, it's much too small for an architect's office. But the parlor on the other side of the entry, extending to the back of the house, having large windows reaching the detailed crown molding at the stamped metal ceiling, well, it was in high style in those days. It's just perfect for an architect's office, just as it must have served Eve for entertaining, you know, those special guests. The parlor begged to be an elegant office. Well, so the dining room was redesigned and furnished as a comfortable parlor with a large couch. For as long as Jason can remember, especially as a little boy, he always felt relaxed and secure and, well, sort of safe, snuggled down in a bed covered with fluffy quilts. So today, since the boys won't be home for several hours, he has plenty of time for a relaxing nap on the dining room couch. Getting comfortable, Jason remembers when he and Vicky discussed buying an Empire-style sofa with padded arms and a carved mahogany crest rail. Oh, it was perfect for the room, but it was too short for him to lie down and stretch out. Too firm to snuggle in. Well, not wide enough for his broad shoulders. So they bought an older American-style sofa, you know, with soft cushions, which is long enough for him to stretch out completely. Jason wiggles his body to snuggle a little further into the downy pillows. He loves it when the pillows billow up around him. He feels warm and protected, and this enables him to sort of turn off the world around him and tune into his personal imaginative world. And what a wonderful world it is. Jason loves his dreams, three or four every night. They're always colorful and, well, kind of exciting, and they bring him to life. Then he brings his dreams to life in his own life and in his architecture. For he frequently pictures solutions to design problems in his dream, and then includes those details in his drawings the next day. It's as though Jason lives as two people in different worlds living and working together. And the way he works, people frequently wonder if maybe, well, just maybe, there are two Jasons working together through the one person that they know. As a small boy, Jason made up long and involved bedtime stories to tell his brother, night after night, when they slept in the same room. He whispered stories from his dreams. But those were not fantasies, for Jason's dreams and the stories are real. Relaxing on the sofa, or, well, more correctly said, relaxing in the sofa, Jason's imaginative world this day begins with visions of construction details for the condos. But these quickly fade as he concentrates on letting seemingly undirected images flow through his mind. Oh, there's a green summer feel that transforms into a busy street scene in a large city. But this city has horses and carriages, not cars. Jason watches a tall man dressed in a dark cloak with a large floppy hat, using a walking stick. He turns a corner a block away. Being intrigued by his strange figure, Jason immediately finds himself at the intersection ahead. And looking around the corner, he's in his green field again. Ahead, the man in the cloak is about to enter a small cave in the hills surrounding the field. The man stops, turns, beckons to Jason, all in one motion, then disappears into the cave. Jason, rushing to catch up, immediately finds himself in the cave. No, it's a tunnel, like the old gold tunnels around Fairbanks. And he can hear the man walking ahead in the dark, and the little click, click of his walking stick on the rock floor. It seems to say, well, follow me, follow me. Jason's not fearful of caves. Oh, he was an active spelunker in high school. And he's rummaged through many old gold mines out by his homestead. He enjoys exploring new realms and different possibilities. Follow me, follow me. Well, how can Jason possibly refuse? He doesn't refuse. He follows the sound deeper into the darkening tunnel. It's too dark to walk without stumbling and falling, but Jason seems to be just sort of, well, floating along. The sound stops. Jason senses light ahead. And in straining to see, well, he discovers the man in the floppy hat. He's vanished. He's gone. He's disappeared. Jason whispers softly to himself while moving quickly to the light ahead. Looking outside of the tunnel, he can only see, well, it's fog. Everywhere, clouds, nothing but clouds, he grumbles softly. Now what? And with that question, the clouds begin dissolving, and he can see again. Another field of oats. No, it's a field of wheat. No, it's tall grass, tall golden grass. And there's another man up ahead. He's standing in the grass. He looks a lot like the man in the floppy hat, kind of the same erect posture and shoulders. Except these shoulders are wearing a white flowing robe. And the man has a sash around his waist. But he also has a cane, and he beckons for Jason to follow him. Then he just sort of walks away. He doesn't even turn around. He just beckons with his cane. Yeah, but it's a friendly gesture, and it's hard to resist. Jason rushes forward through the tall grass, and the man moves on, sort of just out of reach, still beckoning with his cane. Up ahead is a large white temple. Jason remembers this temple. It's a Parthenon on the Acropolis in Athens. Yeah, but this building is not in ruins, it's new. White marble, colorfully decorated, gleaming in the sunlight. Ah, the bright, warm sunlight. But the real Parthenon was surrounded by the Erechtheum and the Temple of Athena and the Propylaea, the gateway to the Acropolis, all of which were built, 2,500 years ago? But here they are for Jason, brand new and complete. Well, it can't be the Parthenon, Jason exclaimed. You know, but it is. Jason's imaginative world frequently takes shape in these, well, delightfully mysterious ways, in which time and space have no hold on him or on his imaginings. No one's around, yet Jason can hear sort of familiar sounds. They're street sounds of people and animals echoing from buildings along the way, leading up to the Parthenon. From both sides of the way, but there are no buildings, just sounds of a busy ancient marketplace. And the smells of, what is that? Jason can't identify those smells, just some are sweet and some are not so sweet, but they make him feel alive and finally aware of himself. Up ahead, the robed man climbs the steps to the Parthenon, to the colonnade, and beckons to Jason. Then he just gradually fades away from sight. He doesn't walk into the temple, he just fades away. Jason rushes on, not walking, not running, not even floating. He just appears at the top step where the man disappeared. Would Jason disappear? Hell, who cares? And with that thought, Jason realized that he, the real Jason, is part of this scene, and he loses all sense of himself as the architect, and realizes he's within and part of this sort of strange world. He's not merely witnessing these events. Here he is, thinking and feeling and seeing. But what is he seeing and experiencing? What's really happening? Jason, looking down to take a step, sees sandals. He's wearing sandals, which in itself isn't unusual. Well, for he frequently wears leather sandals, even in Alaska's harsh winters, because he doesn't like being limited by the world around him. But these sandals are straw, without straps. And he's wearing a white robe, like the old man's robe. Well, at least he doesn't have a cane. With his usual inner smile, as Jason thinks of a cane, one appears in his hand, at his command, just like the old man's cane. Then he wonders, what makes me think he's old? He walked slightly and very lightly, and even with a cane, he didn't shuffle. He didn't hunch over. And I'm not certain he's old, at least not old in body. Looking at the cane in his hand, Jason remembers, well, when he carried a cane in college, it made him look and feel elegant and distinguished. Now, the girls thought he looked silly. He didn't care. He lost it one day and never found it again, until now. Looking carefully at the cane in his hand, Jason exclaimed, "This is my old cane." Then, startled by the discovery, he drops it. But the cane doesn't fall. It just sort of hovers in the air. Then it fades away, just as the old man faded away. And Jason can again hear the sounds of the marketplace. They're all around him, and the street behind him. People and children and animals and confusion and noise. He doesn't even turn around. He knows the market is there, and so are the people and the animals. "This is my home," he exclaims happily and strides confidently into the temple. And as he feels the warm sunlight vanish from his back, he expects to enter a cool, dark interior space. But it isn't dark. It's cool and bright, but not sunlight bright. It's just bright and perfectly clear. And Jason can see into every corner of the temple. That sound again. The vibrant ring of a cane striking solid marble. not that fake marble used today. It's the clear, resounding marble of yesterday. Oh, Jason loves the sound, but it's suddenly drowned out by a rush of noises and the confusion of people milling all around him. They're dressed in white robes like the old man, and like Jason. Some of them are carrying scrolls and sheets of parchment, and most of them are talking quietly in whispered tone. And they seem to just sort of, well, they just be there. And in that, the temple is filled with confusion. Yet it's peaceful, noisy but quiet. This is an entirely different world than the one Jason's accustomed to. But what world is this? And what's happening? And no matter what, it's not like a dream. People move aside as Jason shuffles hastily across the great hall, doubting and questioning every step. Then suddenly everyone stands motionless, staring right through him. When he stops and questions whether or not he should follow the old man. It's as though time and life stand still, waiting for Jason to decide and then to move on. When he takes the next step, well, everything returns to normal, and the sound and the movement come back to fill the temple. It had happened again. When in doubt, Jason's world presents him with silence and waits. And when his decision is made, his world continues all around him. He'd experienced that before. Flap, flap. Jason stops, then takes a cautious step. Flap. His sandals are noisy. He's accustomed to sandals with straps and buckles. Flap, flop. These just slip onto his feet without heel straps. He takes another step. Flop. Damn, Jason exclaims. Can't even walk quietly. For the first time in his life, Jason is embarrassed. He tries scuffing along. Scuff. Still too noisy. So he lifts his foot flat and places it carefully on the floor. Plop. He has to learn how to walk in these sandals or make a noisy fool of himself. Oh, well, flap, flap, flap. As Jason approaches the alcove where the cane sounds disappeared, he notices it's bathed in soft white light, lit from the inside. I wonder how they do that. Don't see any windows, don't see any skylight. The alcove where the old man is seated at a table with others is open to the great hall. Yet it seems completely closed off by sort of a strange light that is projected into the temple. The old man beckons and indicates Jason is to sit beside him. It's a gentle motion, but one that can't be refused. So Jason just sort of flaps through the light into the alcove, where the sights and sounds of the great room suddenly cease, as if he's entered a separate room and shut the door. Strange, Jason thinks, as he turns around quickly to see what happened. The old man speaks to Jason. His voice is quiet but commanding. Come, Hothir, sit here. Jason turns quickly. You've got the wrong guy. My name's Jason, or Benjamin, if you prefer, not Hothir. Hothir, my son, is your name here. It means the saved one. My name is Mattathiah. Come, sit here, sit beside me, and we'll talk. Jason scuffs slowly toward the old man, thinking, he's not so old. And he looks familiar. He looks sort of like me. Or as I will probably look in the future. No. He looks like my father. But he's not my father. He's more like me. At the chair close to Mattathiah's right hand, Jason sits down stiffly. Well, he expects to be uncomfortable. The chair's too wide, and the seat's too high, and the armrests are too low, and the back's too straight. It has to be uncomfortable, but it isn't. Jason sits stiffly and erect and feels surprisingly comfortable. Something has to be wrong. Jason's never comfortable sitting erect. Jason slouches. He always slouches. He remembers his mother constantly saying, "Benjamin, stop slouching. Sit up straight." He hates sitting up straight. He likes to wiggle and slouch. Jason's memory and his thoughts about his mother calling him Benjamin are interrupted by he's trying to remember. What did the old man call him? What was it? Oh, yeah, Hothair. What a strange name. I like Jason much better, or even Benjamin. "We've waited many years for you to return, Hothair." The old man's voice is soft, but it startles Jason. "When you left us, we gave you the name Benjamin to take with you, which means son of the right hand, and Jason, which signifies that you are a helper and a deliverer and a healer." Robert indicates one who is of shining fame. "You see, Hothair, your name has always been important to you and to us. You are as you are called, and you have been properly called all of your life." The old man stops speaking and looks softly at Jason. "It's been a long time. Welcome, my son. For you are my son, you know. You are my right hand and my helper, and your fame shall be renowned." Just as Jason starts to speak, he realizes this isn't a dream. For though he frequently participates directly in his dream, you know, this is entirely different. He can think and act and fully share in what's going on. And, you know, in his dreams, he experiences the actions and then he just sort of knows what is happening and reacts. But this is entirely different. He can think and make decisions, or he can remain undecided and not participate. "Actually, this dream is real. Yes, Hothair, we are real, because this is your reality." "Old man." Oh, damn, I can't call him old man. What's his name? Oh, yeah, Mattathiah. That's what he said. "He knows exactly what I'm thinking." Jason's thoughts are racing in all sorts of directions, and from the sights and sounds to the silence to the strange alcove and to his funny name and then to Mattathiah and back to his next word. "Where am I? What is this place? And who are you? And what am I doing here?" Jason sort of dislikes people who ask a bunch of questions without pausing or waiting for answers. Then he hears himself asking again, "Who are you?" "I'm you. We are the oneness of physical spiritual. We are individually one." Jason listens carefully to Mattathiah and hears himself, "Oh yeah, sure. I've heard that stuff before. Words that don't really make any sense. They don't mean anything." But Mattathiah looks right through Jason's words and continues, "Jason, in spirit, you are Hothair, and you are now in spirit." Mattathiah smiles and pauses to see what impression these words make on Jason. "You left us many times before to enter the physical world and fulfill your purpose. Now you are, you're once again beginning to consciously realize and express the physicalness of yourself as Jason and the spirit of yourself as Hothair. And then experience them together. The question is, which will you choose as your oneness? To be as physical or as spiritual? Which will you choose as your home? Will it be your true self as Hothair and the real world here with us? How do you like what you've created as Jason? Has it been satisfying and fulfilling? Or has it been sort of painful and limited? I left you, Jason asked aloud, though not really expecting an answer. But he doesn't know what else to say. You mean I lived here before? Is that why I felt so at home outside? When I'd lived here before? This temple was built more than 24 centuries ago. How could I? I was born in Cleveland, and that's in Ohio, you know. What are you talking about? Are you talking about reincarnation? I thought that was just talk. You mean I've lived as Jason Roberts before? Hell, you mean Jason suddenly stopped speaking when he realized he's just sort of babbling on with questions and wallowing in his own questions without waiting for Mattathiah to say anything. Would you believe me, Hothir, if I said yes to your questions? Would you? Well, sure I would, Jason declares. But he can't sit still and wait for answers, so he interrupts when he gets an answer, an old habit that frequently annoys people. But Mattathiah is not the least bit annoyed. Would you believe me if we told you about your past lives? About some of your previous lives in the physical world? Would you accept then, Hothir? Well, sure. But how do you know who I was? And what I've lived and done before. Well, the records reveal. The record? You mean the Akashic records? Jason interrupts again, but he's much too excited to care. You mean the Akashic records actually exist? That everything I do and everything I've ever done and everything I say, even my thoughts and feelings, are written down? Well, sure, I'll believe you, but I have to hear this first. Hear about my past lives. Can you really do that? Mattathiah picks up his cane and taps it lightly on the floor. But to Jason, it sounds like a huge brass gong thundering in the alcove, and probably echoing throughout the temple. Yet there's an unusual calm in the sound, and a pleasantness. It's sort of commanding. Jason doesn't understand this place. Everything seems to just be one thing, yet everything is something different. But he knows, somehow he knows exactly what everything is. How do you suppose that is? Appearances here are confusing at first. Time speeds up and slows down, or stops altogether. And even harsh sounds are pleasant. Everything in the temple is different and unreal. But the small man who appears at the second tap of Mattathias cane, well, he's real enough. No illusion about that. Though instead of walking into the alcove, he just sort of, well, he just appears. But Jason's no longer surprised by such things, for, well, he's kind of feeling right at home. And strangely, he feels quite at ease with the little man. Mattathias starts to introduce the man. This is, wait. His name is Gabbai. His name is Gabbai, Jason exclaims without thinking. I know his name. Am I right? You're quite correct, my son. The delight and excitement in Jason's recognizing Gabbai shows on Mattathias' face and echoes in his voice. But he remains calm. Well, he tries to. And he's from a family of Benjaminites who lived in Jerusalem centuries ago. How do I know all of that? Mattathias waits to be certain that Jason asks all of his questions. He's patient, not patronizing, and he waits for Jason to settle down. And he waits for him to listen carefully. Jason looks nervously around the room, wondering why everyone's so quiet. And as he looks at Gabbai for some sort of, an assurance and a support, he sees that Gabbai's carrying a large golden book. Jason hadn't noticed that before. He was too excited about recognizing an old friend, and he was too concerned about what was happening. As Gabi moves forward and stands in front of Jason and in front next to Mattathiah, he opens the book and begins reading softly. The purpose of this reading of Benjamin Jason from the records of your past is to show you how you can, in your present life today, make yourself aware of your karma and clear yourself of any negative subconscious effects so you can feel, well, within your soul, that truth is yours to perceive and carry within you. And, well, to show you how to live a life of utmost value, both to yourself and to your God and to your brother man. Judea, 1st century AD, Roman blood, an overseer of the waterworks, a tall man, quick, direct, used to being obeyed, a duelist, but with words, never with weapons. On the other hand, you hated cruelty, and you were fair in your mind and in your relations with people. Oh, you required seclusion in order to think out solutions to those problems that, well, they came up in your work, which was to divert and channel water, to create aqueducts, to bring fertility into barren areas. Perhaps your greatest difficulty, Hothir, was to fall into conflict with higher authorities, and to resist when you knew or felt that the authorities and their instructions were wrong. This is the prerogative of a superior, and comes hard on the creative individualist, as you were in that lifetime. Gabi pauses and looks up at Jason, who nods and smiles, then nods again and smiles broadly. He's beginning to relax and wants to hear more. So, with a gesture from Jason, Gabi continues reading. Now, in a consequence, rather than conform with the mistaken orders, well, as you perceive them to be, you tried working within them, and yet, at the same time, you tried to construct, sort of on an individual basis, a unique solution within the framework of the improper orders, as you perceive them to be. And this turned out to be, well, in your life, a very happy solution. Because the higher authorities, when they came back to inspect the works, could see that their instructions had been complied with, while at the same time, you knew they had not. This is not deceit. It is the use of wisdom. Well, if you can perceive that. Jason understands and smiles happily, for he's lived this way all of his life, quite successfully. When your spirit and mind are in conflict, your emotions will always lead your mind to form even greater conflicts and resistance. And yet, your spirit is rich in knowledge and wisdom and light, which you have gained from many lives and many happenings. It is to bring that knowledge forward into your present life in a practical way, to experience and to share truth with others, that you have returned to physical life. And though this may seem, well, a paradox to you now, as time goes on, it will be made manifestly clear that success in any other form will have little value or little merit or meaning, save your relationship with your own and others' soul or spirit. Call it whatever name you like. Now, in your private life, in your personal life and relationships, well, you did not use the same degree of self-possession and wisdom, such as you met a situation head-on and locked horns with it, and you were frequently hurt as a consequence. This applies only with males, not only with males, but especially with females. There were a number of women who played a prominent part in your life at that time. Well, you were good looking, and they liked your challenging ways, and your ways with words, and your intimate understanding. There were two marriages, Sharon. And this is strange. Even when you married the second time, your first wife, Sharon, stayed around. And you were on good terms, well, even better terms as a friend than when you were married. That was because your restless mind and high individuality, which we notice, well, it's employing through your makeup even today, they were expressing greatly and fully for yourself and those around you. There were several children. Gabby pauses and reads ahead, declaring quietly, "Well, we'll leave that life now. We have the personal points from it, which relate to the progress of your soul and to your spirit." But Jason is too excited and impatient to hear more. So without a word, but with a sort of a broad smile and a simple motion, Jason urges Gabby to continue. "Later you came into a physical life which was also connected with water. During the 7th century in America, you were an Indian, making use of waterways in the Dakota lands. The tribe was Sioux, or the nation from which the Sioux grew. Embodied in strong physical form, you had a fine mind that thought clearly and distinctly and individually and expansively. Again, you were a good organizer of confusing and difficult beliefs and ideas, and you were quick to show others how to make greater use of their unique wisdom and their understanding. You were a fine individual and a good teacher, a respected leader, and you were good with animals and you liked exploring. You have a very close affinity for all of life on all levels. And as you bring these understandings into your divine mind and self, you'll be better able to deal with every aspect of your present life. In this life, well, there was a strong psychic aspect to your nature, which you made excellent use of in that, well, you were able to feel an inner self and life, and the invisible around you, which you could see and frequently communicate with. You felt a rapport with the trees and plants and animals and with the elements, and you had a deep respect, a tremendous respect for the Holy Spirit. That's the spirit of life, is what that was. And with so much bounty constantly being offered to everyone, you were terribly distressed by human beings not living in a harmonious state without conflicting ways and beliefs. It sort of disturbed you immensely to see individuals in hiding or denying their full awakened selves and their true wisdom about themselves and about others, or who were in a violent temper with another person, particularly over someone of the opposite sex, for you felt this was such a waste of energy and life. Now, as to your personal relationships in this life, there was a good way of mating and a happy marriage and 4 children. It is to be noted, however, that this life varies from the others and from future lives in that you were not directly concerned with having to fulfill orders from a higher source. This was a much freer life, and you gave orders. For though you were not the chief of the tribe, you were high in your particular field, or in your calling, which related to all forms of planting and growing, and especially with watering and tending. We'll call this your cultivating and nurturing side. and you were living close to spirit. As he reads from the book, Gebbie turns each page tenderly. They seem to be parchment. But the pages are almost transparent, as though they can be read from either side, from the past or from the future, such that as each page is turned, Jason experiences a different passage of time. His time and the time of his past lives. Well, that's the end of 4C. We can start 5C, but I think it's late enough. We'll stop right there. Obviously, the minute that Jason sat down on the couch and fluffed himself into the pillows, that this whole process of suscitation for him began as I read. And this is not like a short dream or without detail. It's very precise and very clear and full of details, as we'll get into next week when we read 5C. So, that's the first part of Jason's story. And from being on the couch, that was the moment of the beginning of his first expression of suscitation. Of course, he'd been doing a lot of this in his dream work, in his architecture, and it even followed a sort of a practice of meditation, but it was just allowing the images to occur. And he had practiced that process of letting images occur in his life that brought it to the point where Jason just sort of entered into this experience of suscitation without any effort. So, there we are. Anybody have any comments, or shall we close it up right there?
Well, that was great, Roger. Thank you very much.
Okay.
Hey, I just had one question, Raj. Did you remember all that when you got off the couch, or did it come to you back more clearly as you were, like, writing it? Well, like, all the detail and everything.
You will hear the what occurred in getting back. It's kind of like when you get up and all of a sudden your whole surroundings are all around you, and the activities you got to get involved in, and like a dream that just sort of slips away. Well, can you recall your dreams and bring them back slowly so that then you can remember this clearly. As soon as you come back, as in Jason's case, you'll find out all sorts of things started occurring, and then when he did it again, more things occurred. So each time it's kind of like remembering a dream. You have to practice yourself to recall or remember the dream in great detail and write that down.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. So there's 4C. Do you want to hear 5C?
Yes, please.
Okay, we'll do 5C.
Is it on the website too?
No, it's not up there yet.
5.
It's missing a final edit, so it isn't up, no. But then we'll do 5C next week, and then 6C, and then 7C.
Another question.
Go.
Is the bee in your name Benjamin?
No, that's a pseudonym.
Roger B. Cutting.
That my B is Bruce, but I did the same thing when I was in the fifth grade in school. in a two-room school, and the teacher was teaching. There's three classes in the school that I was in, and she was teaching the other class, and I had done all that stuff, and I was bored to death what she was teaching us, so I got down there and did everything that Jason did in writing my name with flair and style and trying to sort of get a declaration that was me. And if I write my name and it does not include the B, it isn't me, it's somebody else. My name is Roger B, not Bruce, don't like Bruce, Roger B. Cotting. Actually, it was Roger B. Marbach at one time. But so I went through all the same sort of things that I put Jason through in this. Okay?
Okay, thank you.
All righty. Then we'll go on with 4C next week. Listen in.
Okay, thank you.
Roger, excellent.
I will. Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Thank
you,
Roger.
Bye.
Bye, guys.
I thought you'd come in here and banged into my table. I didn't see you. That's because you're over there. Okay.
If you're on. I was trying to say something. I don't know. I guess my mic didn't work properly. I just noticed the way you presented this story was so amazing. I really enjoyed to picture it because I really felt that I was part of the scene and could follow all those details. So it's really, really nice the way you did it. Okay. I really felt it very deep. And then let's see again when I can come this week and I'll talk more with you. I'd love to do that.
Well, call me when you decide.
Yeah, kind of Wednesday comes to my mind.
Well, don't let it come to mind. Make a decision.
Okay.
Is it going to be Wednesday?
Would Wednesday maybe afternoon or noonish afternoon, something like that?
What time? Pick a time.
Around 1 o'clock.
Okay.
Okay, then.
Bye now.
You there. Good night.
Bye. What? Oh, it's way over there. Nope.